What's up, Beardos? In today's episode, we're going to answer listener questions as we dip our toes into a mini mailbag.
Basically, our whole philosophy boils down to don't be a jerk.
Don't really answer the question first try. Not answering the question. I really hope people didn't tune in to hear us talking about beer.
Welcome to the show. I'm Paul.
And I'm Andy.
And we are the Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes at thebeardedvegans.com. And you can always reach us by emailing thebeardedvegans@gmail.com.
Andy, what's going on here? It's not a decade of episodes yet. We're doing a mini mailbag in the middle between 10 episodes. This is unheard of.
Listen, Paul,
this is unprecedented.
We do what we want. But before we get to any of that, we have a little bit of housekeeping to do, Paul. We got word from the Corrections and Omissions Department, some things that we're going to go on the record and let everybody know that James McWilliams article that we talked about the moral imperative for vegans to eat insects. And we said, oh, that came out in 2017. How did we not talk about it then? And turns out it was updated and edited in 2017. The actual article came out in 2014. So mystery solved there, Paul.
And are you talking about James McWilliams of Meet Me Halfway fame?
I am talking about James McWilliams of Meet Me Halfway fame. Speaking of which, During last week's episode, we reviewed the film Meet Me Halfway. And in it, there was a segment that I thought was very bizarre and out of nowhere, a little like Portlandia satire, or I guess, you know, modeling after a Portlandia section, and neither you nor I had any idea where that came from. It didn't seem like it called back to anything earlier in the film. We thought maybe there was some like joke that got cut from an interview, but they still kept the callback to it. And I just want to thank the flood of people that have let us know that it is referencing the first episode of the first season of Portlandia, the Colin the Chicken bit, in which the two stars of the show go to visit a farm to meet the chicken that they're going to eat.
There it is. There you have it. Yes, Sandy, we apparently it went well over our heads, but many listeners, it did not go over your head. So thank you. Thank you for pointing us in the right direction with that.
So now we just have to wait for this episode to come out while we bear the brunt of another week's worth of people letting us know. I feel like it's definitely better. Like when people send us that, I'm like, oh, people are listening. That's really nice. So definitely keep the corrections coming. Paul, in my head, I feel like still a weird choice to include a reference to a 10-year-old bit. But I guess as someone who tries to shove as many Seinfeld and Big Lebowski references into our episodes as possible, usually those fly under the radar. But I guess I don't have any ground to stand on to say that that's a weird choice.
Yeah, let me just, Andy, quickly look up. When was Droopy Dog created? Ah, yes, 1943. All right.
Droopy Dog is a beloved cartoon institution, Paul.
But and I guess in the defense of Brian Caitman, that bit was probably filmed at least two years ago, so maybe potentially more relevant at the time as well.
Yeah, although Paul, I do have to say, if the intended audience of this film are people that have never even had an avocado, what do you think the cross section is of people who internalized that Portlandia bit from 10 years ago and have never had an avocado?
That's just two circles very far apart from each other, Andy.
Floating out in space. All right. Well, thanks again for everyone for sending that in. It sent me a nice, I watched the whole episode. It was a fun time. All right. Follow-up time. A couple episodes ago, we were talking about this bizarre instance of this news story that keeps resurfacing every couple of years about a vegan being mad at a non-vegan that's eating tofu. That's essentially the gist of it. And Something that we didn't actually mention in that episode that I feel like would be worth mentioning was this email from Rachel, who said, "The only time it's appropriate to be upset at a non-vegan eating vegan food is when you're at an event with food and only 5% of it is vegan, but the non-vegans eat all the vegan food. I'm still hungry." I can't believe we didn't bring that up, Paul, because I agree. That's like the only time when I'm like, please leave me some sustenance.
It's tough, Andy. I got to say, it's tough because especially if at, let's say it's like a work event or something and you are the vegan and everyone's bringing a dish and you bring a dish that maybe is like the only substantial vegan dish that's there. I have to say it is tough though, because looking at it from the advocacy perspective, you're like, I made this dish that I have deemed good and I want other people to try it to say, oh, vegan food isn't that bad. And maybe I do enjoy having some vegan food, but at the same time, like you just pointed out, and like Rachel pointed out, you're also like, okay, I've brought this dish that is the only thing I can eat, so please leave some for me. Please, I want everyone to partake in this, but also leave me a substantial amount. So there's a struggle there.
Well, yeah, I think that struggle sort of speaks to how do I balance trying to be a good advocate versus also advocating for myself and making sure that I'm not living a miserable life in order to, to be a vegan, essentially. So like I wouldn't want to have to go without food in order to like introduce new people to vegan food. Like you're sitting there at a wedding the whole time. You know, I feel like if we were to give like a hot tips for vegans going to weddings, you know, at the start of this podcast, we would have said, bring a couple protein bars, eat some, some snack mix in the car before you go in, something like that. But also kind of it's like, I don't know. There's something that feels wrong about that feeling. Like I should have the mindset that I should have to, obviously not like starve, but like go super hungry in order to be like the best advocate kind of thing.
Yeah, no, Andy, I do think there's certainly many different situations that one can find themselves in and different situations in terms of how predictable the predictability of how much food you are going to have. Like it can be certainly very uncertain at some times where you just get there and you're like, oh no, I thought there was going to be so much more and there's one thing that I can eat, so please don't eat that, versus I guess the situation that I was saying where you're bringing food to like a potluck or something or some work event and you know you're probably going to bring the only vegan thing, and if you so choose, taking that opportunity to say, I'm going to make this thing for other people and I'm just going to eat before I get here because I know I'm really not going to eat that much, but I'm going to make this thing so that other people can have it. I do feel like there's different situations that can definitely, there's different levels of planning and planning ahead and all that stuff. But for sure, I agree with Rachel that there have been times when I'm like, don't touch that. Stop eating that.
Don't you dare. You know, for my sister's wedding many years ago, for the dessert, they did a cupcake tier as opposed to, an actual cake that gets cut into. And, it was a caterer. The caterer wasn't making vegan cupcakes. So my sister was like, do you want to make, a dozen or whatever, two dozen cupcakes to include that'll be vegan? And so, of course, I took her up on that. And dare I say, my cupcakes looked much better than the caterer's cupcakes. They had a little raspberry on top. It was great. And they were also the first to go. And so I made sure I snatched one for myself and told any other vegan that was there, make sure you get one. But everyone gravitated towards them. And I felt very proud that that was the first thing to go.
Yeah, no, that's cool. I'll also say, I'm glad you mentioned, Andy, that there were other vegans, because in my mind, if someone is like planning something out like a caterer or something and you say to them, there is going to be a single vegan person there, but then the caterer makes 12 cupcakes. I feel like that's like inviting other people to eat in the things, versus if they have made the one thing, Andy is the vegan here, Paul is the vegan here, I'm going to make one or two cupcakes or purchase them for that person. Then I feel like it's more clearly, this is Paul's thing, this is Andy's thing. But not that I can't house 12 cupcakes, Andy.
I was going to say, Paul, in that situation, is it a moral imperative to eat 12 cupcakes?
But it just feels to me, it's like, okay, who are these 12 cupcakes for? Is it for the one person that they know is vegan there? But I don't know. This is we're getting into the weeds with this one, I feel, Andy. We could probably move on from here.
Let's get into this mailbag, Paul. I feel like we need a short version of our mailbag theme song, but nonetheless, here it is. Full-length theme song.
Because the mail never stops. It just keeps coming and coming and coming. There's never a let-up. It's relentless. Every day it piles up more and more and more, and you got to get it out. And the more you get out, the more it keeps coming in. And then the barcode reader breaks, and it publishes clearinghouse debt.
All right, all right, all right.
When you control the mail, you control information.
So the mailbag, typically I say these are culled from our, you know, Instagram, Facebook comments and DMs and voicemail line and all of that stuff. All of these just coming in through our the classic channel, thebeardedvegans@gmail.com. But don't forget, if you ever want to submit your questions, you can send us that email or
call them anytime you need with your moral quandaries. It's 3237 Beardo.
And it just makes me so happy when people send in those voicemails. And I believe we'll have a couple fun voicemails to play for people on the main mailbag happening in 4 episodes. So again, get those questions in.
Andy, let's get right into this. Our first email coming in from Shannon G, who asks, I recently saw a vegan activist say that humane meat was actually worse for animals than a factory farm. The reason was that it is a greater act of betrayal to raise an animal kindly and then kill them, rather than treat them consistently, aka poorly, their whole life. What do you think?
Before I even answer, Paul, have you ever seen anyone else use this as a rebuttal for like the humane meat argument?
I don't think I have, Andy. And I'm surprised I haven't, because I'm like, on the surface, I'm like, I feel like this is an interesting rebuttal.
I mean, it's an interesting question. I don't think I had ever really heard anyone say this as well. So I guess it had me thinking a little bit, but I feel like bigger picture, zoom back, I feel like it doesn't matter. I think that we can acknowledge that there are like degrees of horribleness, yet still want all of the bad things to stop happening, essentially. But in the spirit of the question, to actually try to answer it, I feel like thinking about it this way is not really taking into account the animal's experience. You know, like this feels like this is something that we are thinking about in the way that we're perceiving the situation, but it doesn't feel like it actually would like have any difference or matter to the animal. So, you know, and obviously we don't know the context of this comment or what the discussion was or what the nuance that was added on or caveats, all that stuff. But to me, it feels like the type of thing that someone would say because they feel like they need to have some sort of rebuttal to humane meat. You know, someone saying, well, I get my animal flesh from a local farm or whatever it is, that they'd like need something beyond just saying it's wrong to kill animals. But I feel like I feel like the ethical argument of we shouldn't take the life of anyone that doesn't want to die outside of like a survival situation, to me, that is strong enough. And I think that to me, this argument just doesn't feel like a relatable one to me, because I think anyone, or at least for me, if I asked myself, what shoes would I rather be in? I would rather be the animal on the humane farm than the one that's living a life of abject misery for the whole time. Obviously, I would rather be free, you know, outside of that situation entirely. But I guess I just don't feel like I could have any argument that it's actually worse for the humane thing, even though from our perspective looking in, we understand that perhaps that's a bigger sense of betrayal. Like if someone we love kills us, that's a huge thing for betrayal. But what do you think, Paul?
Andy, I think I'm in alignment with how you are thinking, but for different like reasons. Or I should say my conclusion is similar to yours, but for different reasons. I think starting with the general view, like you did, pulling out to like a very broad view, I would say that in my mind, this rebuttal is not going to be widely accepted by non-vegans. Like I feel like this sort of comment wouldn't make a non-vegan go, oh, you're right, I should stop doing this thing. If they're already kind of eating animals and they're ingrained in this sort of system, I feel like this appeal to like a betrayal of compassion or something, I feel like is not going to be the thing that's going to reach them. I could be wrong about that. And obviously different things work for different people, of course, but that's my inkling. And now actually kind of zooming in and examining it a little bit, I feel like similar to what you said, where is this really taking into consideration the animal's perspective, or is it just like the perceived feelings that the animal would have? Are we personifying the animals and projecting human emotions on the animals that we don't necessarily know if they have or not? And I say that because the imagery that this sort of language evokes, when you're saying like, it's betraying the animal because we were raising them kindly and then we killed them, the imagery that evokes for me is like the farmer went outside every day and was hugging the animal and like went on walks with the individual animals. And it evokes this kind of like personal one-on-one relationship that the farmer had with the animal before they then, you know, slit their throat or whatever. And I feel like the real life thing is not that. When they say humanely raised farms, it's like, or humanely raised meat, it's just like this animal had more room to walk around before they were killed, or they were in an open pasture instead of a closed gated, you know, facility where they only had a 10 by 10 room to stand in. And again, I mean, Andy, just like whoever is saying this, I don't know what the animal has experienced. I can't voice that for them, but to me, that's not going to like make them bond with the farmers any more than if they were in these like more confined spaces. Now, of course, if they're in these confined spaces and the humans that they're interacting with are like hurting them or abusing them in some way, obviously the animal is probably going to be adverse or have a negative relationship with the farmers. But again, even with the humane farms, I don't think that the farmers are trying to foster personal relationships with the animals that would then lead to this betrayal, you know? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, case in point, the film that we reviewed last week, Meet Me Halfway, they went to, was it White Oak? I think the farm that the ASPCA person was like, this is the place that you must go. They're, you know, 10 billion over certified. They've got all the certifications and And over the course of that, of Brian interviewing the main rancher, our favorite Southern lawyer, asked him like, do you have names for the pigs? Do you know all of their names? And the you know, the guy running the operation said, well, I forget if it was 200 or 2000, you know, but I have so many pigs here at a time that I can't possibly like name them all and remember their names, you know? So I feel like that is a real illustration of what you're saying, that people think they have this one idea of what the humane local farm is. And it's very different from that. Like maybe there's like an incredibly, absolutely minuscule minority of farms that is just like a farmer with three pigs that he really loves or something like that, or thinks he loves. But that's just not the reality of it. And Paul, I feel like I can hear people's like keyboard fingers warming up and stuff right now. I don't want this to be a endorsement of you know, the quote unquote humane meat or welfare standards or anything like that. Obviously, we are opposed to any and all animal agriculture, but you know, just for the purposes of answering this question, and I do believe that it is a betrayal. In fact, friend of the show, Hope Bohannick, the host of Hope for the Animals, wrote a book a while ago called The Ultimate Betrayal: Is There Happy Meat? Like, I do believe that it is a betrayal, but I feel like you're saying, Paul, that betrayal is, it's something that we're projecting onto it that's not the experience of the animal, is likely not the experience of the animal.
Yeah, and Andy, you know, I'm thinking about it a little bit more, and I wonder if it's, if a more appropriate word besides betrayal would be like horrific surprise, because to me, the quote unquote best case scenario or the most humane farm, the best scenario situation that they could be living in is probably one where they are just kind of living their day-to-day life unaware of what's going to happen, not facing any explicit abuse while they're being raised. And then all of a sudden one day they just get killed for reasons unbeknownst to them. It just happens. And so again, maybe this is a semantic difference, but it's more of like a horrific surprise than a betrayal. And Andy, you just said, you know, I don't want people to think this is an endorsement of this sort of stuff. It's certainly not an endorsement of this stuff, even if what I'm saying sounds like what I think is the argument that humane farms use, which is we have them nice and happy, and then it's just one bad day, and that's it. I think that's, you know, that's the sort of phrasing that they use to promote themselves. And to be clear, I think it's all wrong and it's all bad and we shouldn't be exploiting them at all. So this is not me endorsing them.
Paul, I almost wonder if ambush would be like the appropriate word for that kind of thing. The like the negative surprise. And I think the reason that we're kind of interested in picking this apart, because, you know, like we're saying, we are not endorsing local farms, like whatever. But I think that by like discussing this, I think that we're kind of mirroring in many ways what the non-vegan who is challenged with this notion is actually going to respond to this. Like, we've kind of already said this, but I just don't feel like this is a strong rebuttal when we're doing our advocacy. And so I just feel like we don't need to go down this path. I think we have a very clear cut, very simple answer as to why animals that are treated better still should not be, you know, raised and killed for food or otherwise exploited, you know?
And Andy, what is an ambush if not a negative surprise?
Absolutely.
I agree with you because, Andy, do you think that this specific rebuttal to the humane meat saying like, oh no, it's actually worse than that. Like, do you think that in some way that almost admits that there is something inherently different about the humane farms? When in fact, what my hope would be if I'm having this conversation is to say, no, it's exploiting animals is the thing that is bad. And it doesn't matter if it's at a factory farm or a humane farm, it's all exploitation and it's all bad. The end product is it's exploit, or the fundamental piece of it all is that it's all exploitation. So I almost wonder if even like separating them like that gives that person, the non-vegan in that conversation, it almost gives them like you're agreeing to them that there is something different about it. And if you say this to them, if you say, oh no, it's actually a betrayal and it's worse, if the person then says, oh, I don't buy that at all, then it's almost like you've made a distinction that there is something different about it, but your argument for why humane meat is not good is they don't accept that. Then they're like, oh, okay, cool. So I guess humane meat is the way to go. This is a stretch, maybe. This is a stretch.
Yeah, I mean, like I understand why we're trying to impart that there's no difference, but it almost makes me feel like it's the like a boy is a mouse is a dog is a flea, you know, like what, like that whole argument. And it's like, I understand where that's coming from, but I also think that it's okay for us to acknowledge that animals are different from one another, and it's their differences that make us beautiful, you know, and that like make this world such an interesting, wonderful place. I don't know. It just feels like almost disingenuous to be like, there's no difference between the humane meat and like the factory farm kind of situation. Even though obviously what we're talking about is sort of what you're doing is immoral regardless. And I get that. But I also think that people that are, if you're arguing with someone that like, there's literally no difference at all, I don't know. I feel like people can use that as like they're going to say we're denying reality or something.
Yeah, no, I do get what you're saying. I agree with what you're saying is that it's okay to acknowledge that there's a difference, but while also saying they are still bad for not exactly the same reason, but there's some underlying fundamental reason why I disagree with both of those things.
Yeah, like I was saying, I think there's degrees of unethical things in this world, of horrible things in this world, and we can acknowledge that while still insisting on the underlying message that it's still unethical and therefore we should not partake.
Yeah. Yeah.
This next email comes in from Steph, who wrote, this is going to be a little random, but I sent my friend this video, and I guess we'll put a link to this in the show notes, but essentially it's two people on, it's not a roller coaster exactly. It's like, it seems like it's one of those things where two people sit in this pod on like a giant rubber band at like a fairground or a Six Flags type place, and they get launched up into the air. Am I doing that justice?
I'm sure it has many names, but Slingshot is the one that I know it by.
All right. So Slingshot. And so they're strapped in. This thing gets launched. The camera is with them in the actual Slingshot thing. I honestly think this is probably something that the Slingshot people probably do themselves and probably sell people the videos afterwards, if I had to guess. Mm-hmm. And then out of nowhere, a bird hits one of the participants in the throat slash face kind of area. This person has this like, what the hell moment, and then quickly peels that bird off of them and throws the bird away, throws the bird into the abyss of the open air.
Some might say where birds belong, Andy.
Yeah. All right. I'm having a tough time describing this video, Paul. But anyway, it's accompanied with that Oh No song that's in so many TikTok videos. Mm-hmm. And so Steph says, I sent it to them mostly because I thought it was wild and shocking and okay, kind of funny. I'll admit it. But anyways, my friend asked me if they think the response the person had in the video was vegan. And I was like, shocked face. I have no clue. Like, is peeling a bird off your body and throwing them into the sky? That's the word I was looking for, Paul.
The sky.
The sky. Whilst on a theme park ride, vegan? Is there a better way to handle this situation? In a more broad sense, what is the best way to handle unexpected encounters with animals? Some might call that an ambush, Paul. It's a negative surprise. Do you think that people can train themselves to not have violent reactions, or do you think it's in our nature and not something that can be controlled? Would love to hear your thoughts. Paul, take it away.
This is what I think, Andy. If someone trains themselves to be able to react calmly to this specific situation, a bird flying into their face on a slingshot-esque theme park ride, I feel like that person maybe has too much time on their hand.
Or an extreme amount of dedication, Paul.
Yes, yes, yes. And I think, Andy, my general thought is that a situation like this is so random and so unexpected that yes, most people would have some sort of knee-jerk reaction to get the bird off of them in the way that this person does. I think a much, much more common example or situation that is, I guess, a little bit similar to this is, Andy, a bug landing on you. Let's say like a big bug, a mosquito. If you're like, if you camp a lot or hike a lot or spend a lot of time outdoors, a mosquito landing on you. I think in my mind, that is a situation where you could consciously say, this happens enough that I can train myself. If this is your desire to, you know, shoo the bug off in a way that's not going to kill them while still removing the mosquito from sucking your blood, which is also undesirable. So I think, like, that's a much, much toned down version of what happened in this video, that people could probably make a conscious effort to not have a knee jerk reaction. I will say, Andy, I want to have that sort of control where I don't, you know, I've said this before on the podcast, bugs are lower on my hierarchy of beings like that get my compassion, but I still don't want to harm them if it's possible, and I don't want to kill them if it's possible. But I will be fully honest that, like, I've had a bee or something land on me, and in a very, very quick move, I've like swatted them off, and I think that they have died as a result of that. And it sucks, and I don't want to do that. So I think that that's a situation that could be under our control. It's something that I would like to be better at, and I think I do try to work on that a little bit. But the bird thing, I think, is so unexpected, and it's like, Andy, not to mention that this person is not in like a controlled environment. They are probably whipping through the air at, I don't know, 50 miles an hour, 40 miles an hour. And like, I don't think that I would expect anyone to react differently. And I, of course, I hope that the bird is okay. And I guess it seems like the bird is maybe okay, but like, I couldn't expect anyone to react differently.
I don't know if that bird's okay, Paul. Like, getting hit with a human being at 40 to 50 miles an hour, if not more.
Yeah, that's very sad.
Well, I'll tell you this, Paul. One time I almost crashed my car when a bee flew into it.
But were you crashing your car because of the safety of the bee or because you were worried that the bee was going to sting, hurt you?
I have an irrational, well, I think very rational fear of bees, Paul.
You going to watch that new Candyman movie, Andy?
I cannot wait. I mean, that's part of what makes Candyman so scary, all those bees. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Paul, I hesitated to include this question in our little mini mailbag, despite the fact that I'm sure it would elicit some sort of discussion about this, because I know like a while ago, maybe even two or three years ago at this point, at some point in the podcast, we said that we were kind of tired of answering questions that are people sending us things and saying, is this little weird thing vegan, this ingredient, this situation, whatever, not because they're not worth talking about, but it almost feels like we wanted to foster people's like critical thinking skills and not feel like they have to turn to us to be like, please be the arbiters of what is or isn't vegan. Now, I'm sure most people's motivation is just like, oh, this was interesting. And I like hearing these two guys talk about stuff. So let me send that in. But this question to me was kind of interesting because it is a, is this vegan thing? But it's not an, is this vegan thing that I've really thought about before. Obviously, I've thought about swatting away a mosquito, but I guess like one of my big question would be, is the friend that asked that question, were they vegan? Was this a gotcha moment? Was this like a genuine, honest question? Because it feels like there's no universe in which anyone, vegan or not, could ever be expected to calmly and rashly react to a bird hitting them in the face while on a slingshot, you know? I mean, the last time I remember hearing about anything like that in the news was probably, what, like 20 plus years ago when Fabio got hit by a goose while on a roller coaster? You know, I'm sure there's been incidents in the meantime, but it just feels like such a rare, bizarre occasion. So I echo your sentiments. It's such a random occurrence to think that anyone for any reason should react calmly to that. I mean, I feel like you'd have to be some sort of like highly trained military personnel or something like that. Otherwise, it's like a totally normal, rational response, I think. And this person didn't even really like flip out. This person was like, there's a bird on me. Goodbye, bird. You know, like I thought this person actually handled it pretty, efficiently. And what is the alternative? Hold on to the bird. You know, like what is the alternative that would be considered more compassionate?
Yeah, I, Andy, I don't know. I guess hold on to the bird, because if the bird is injured, then you can be like, I'm going to administer or get this bird somewhere where they can administer aid to the bird. But again, it's like, also, we're talking about, this is what this person has to decide in the split second on this amusement park ride in a second. Like, you know, are they realistically going to be able to administer aid to a bird? Is there like the proper medical equipment that would needed to help this bird out anywhere near this amusement park where they are? So I wouldn't expect anyone to like come to that conclusion in the span of the half a second or 1 second when this happens.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think of something that's like between getting hit in the face with a bird and having a bug land on you, maybe something like a deer, runs in front of your car or something. But again, that's such a quick thing that happens. Obviously, you can take preventative measures. You can drive slower. You can maybe have your high beams on and, you know, things like that. But generally speaking, those feel like less avoidable situations, even though that one is perhaps more predictable.
And Andy, maybe that is the quote unquote more vegan thing, is to be like, this is an area where there might be deer, so I am going to consciously drive slow, keep my head on a swivel, look around, be aware of my surroundings. Like, maybe that's the thing, you know? And I would say same thing with not situations that don't have anything to do with animals. It's like unexpected things happen in life. And even though the outcome, you know, like could be shitty and we're going to feel badly about it because we were the ones that were involved in this thing, I think there are situations that are like, you know, freak incidents or accidents that we really don't have that much control over.
Yeah. And again, kind of pulling back and I guess continuing my thought about how the questions that are like, what is this random XYZ thing vegan for whatever reason, even though they might be interesting to think about. I think that they're, and you know, again, we are a show that delights in dissecting the minutia of living a vegan life. We're almost 300 episodes deep. Obviously, sometimes we're going to talk about these random weird things because that's where the conversation's going to lead us. But I feel like it's important for us to internalize the acknowledgement that our maybe if our end goal is to cause no harm, but we're never going to actually achieve that. And so where can we spend our time and effort and attention on reducing harm? And it feels like what one would have to do to train themselves to react calmly in the face of a bird in the face, or, you know, maybe not, it's not so unreasonable to say, I'm going to just train myself whenever a bug lands on me to react calmly. But it just feels like in terms of time and resource usage, it just feels like a weird place to spend our time. If that's what someone feels drawn to do, that's what they feel like allows them to live out their ethics to the nth degree. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but I just don't feel like this is necessarily wrapped up in a vegan ethic. I think that we acknowledge that there are going to be moments where harm is caused, hopefully inadvertently, but maybe even, you know, intentionally. And this kind of falls under one of those situations where maybe people can train themselves to do that, but I don't think it's a moral imperative. I think there's so many other things that we can be doing to reduce the amount of harm that we're contributing to and to do good in this world that, you know, if any vegan was like, you're not vegan because of the way you reacted in these situations, it feels like a weird frivolous thing, you know, not to downplay the lives of the animals that are affected, but it just feels like a weird frivolous thing for us to be engaging in.
No, I definitely agree with that, Andy. Certainly this does remind me of the recent PETA activism to get the military to stop doing their training that is launching people on slingshot rides and throwing birds at their faces.
I was like, where is this going? But essentially, this question is basically asking us, like, how far should we take our veganism? And our last question is going to speak to that. But before we get to that, we do have a couple of people that we need to thank for helping to fund this podcast, because we are entirely listener supported or listener sustained, as we established a couple of weeks ago. So huge thank you to our latest, newest Patreon donors, Laura S.
Krista Z.
And Jennifer L.
And also big thank you to Emma P.
And Ryan H., who both increased their pledge recently.
And also a big thank you to Maria L.
and Jennifer G., who both just sent us a nice one-time PayPal donation. So huge thank you to everybody that does help to make this podcast more sustainable for us, cover the cost of transcripts, equipment, everything that comes up in the course of running this podcast. It is just so immensely and greatly appreciated. So just again, huge thank you to you. If you want to help support the podcast, you can go to thebeardedvegans.com/beardo, which is spelled B-E-A-R-D-O. And by doing that, you'll come to a page, you can get your PayPal, you can get your Patreon, and also just a link to the store where you can buy the one t-shirt that we have and the one sticker.
You'll come to a page, Andy. Please tell me how else the internet works.
Been a long day, Paul. And also by doing so, you get access to all the bonus episodes we put out. We put two this month out already, so it's a good time. Again, that's thebeardedvegans.com/beardo, and thanks again to everybody.
Yeah, thank you so much to everybody. So, Andy, with that, you've already teased it. Let's get to this last question asked by Jacoby Y. Is there such a thing as being too vegan?
That's it. That is the whole question. We got this email, I want to say maybe 2 years ago, and I received this email and I thought, that's a really interesting question. And we were actually holding on to it. We thought this would make a good like kickoff for a live mailbag type of thing at a VegFest. And then VegFest stopped happening. We had it all planned out. So we're doing it here. We're going to make it happen. You know, I think that there are so many directions that we could go with this conversation, Paul. And I guess that's what's so intriguing to me is just how absolutely open-ended it is. Obviously, you could talk about it perhaps in the direction that, you know, Steph's question kind of implies, which is like, how far should we be taking things in our like personal practice? And I think you could also think about in terms of like your advocacy, like should you feel like you have to speak up at absolutely every possible little second where something potentially anti-animal is being said or done, or, you know, even things like our conversation that we had recently about anti-speciesist language. If you're, you know, your non-vegan mom says something is fishy, for instance, like, do you make that a teachable moment? Do you let that thing slide? And, you know, so I think that's like another way that people can potentially, I don't want to say I'm assessing this as too vegan or not, but some people could view that as being too vegan. Like if you're always talking about veganism too much, and then, yeah, I guess it leads into the personal practice thing, but just like how thoroughly are people maybe researching the foods? Are they looking at the monoendiglycerides and things like that? Is there anything else I'm missing, Paul? What comes to mind when someone says, can someone be too vegan?
Well, I, before I answer that, Andy, I was going to say, you know, I think some people could describe some of the discussions we have on this podcast as being too vegan, you know, diving deep into the minutiae and be like, who cares about this stuff, you know?
Paul, great point. And, you know, I think we say this occasionally, but we don't view this as something that is catered to non-vegans, right? This is people who are kind of on board and they want to really interrogate their beliefs. And, you know, we enjoy talking about these things and dissecting it. But I'm sure that there are a lot of people who tune in and they're like, this is such meaningless drivel. And they're saying like, well, who really cares about, you know, whatever it is that you're talking about right now? Like, that's not saving animals. That's just maybe a little entertaining. So I think that, Paul, that's like a totally reasonable thing for people to say. I think that this podcast is definitely not for everybody. I think a lot of people don't need to dive this deep into things. They just need the big overarching picture and they're good. They're going to go off and do good in the world. So I think that's also a potential assessment of the question.
So what do you think, Andy? Is it possible?
So as I was saying in my preamble to Steph's question, I would never disparage anybody for doing their best to practice their ethics to whatever degree makes them feel that they are living in accordance with their ethics and that they are doing the best that they can to live an ethical life. I do think that, and this will vary for everybody, obviously, but I do think that there are instances in which we put internal pressure on ourselves to be so absolutely thorough and consistent. And I guess I'm talking about like consumer practices in this instance, that it becomes entirely unrelatable to those that we are advocating towards. And my general philosophy is that we are all on this ladder climbing up to the most ethical life possible. And that those who go up 10 rungs and are, you know, living in the woods and growing all their own vegetables, as laudable as that is, I also feel like that's not actually what's going to get the person that's on the first rung to step up. But if I'm on the fourth rung, I'm stepping down half a step and I'm offering my hand and I'm pulling somebody up. So I think that even though I think it's totally understandable, I think it's totally fine and you should do what is going to make veganism work for you. But if we get to a point where we're so obsessive about certain little things and making life really hard for ourselves, that it's not relatable to others. And I also feel like it could potentially just really be a recipe for burnout for ourselves as well. And that this pressure that we put on ourselves, I certainly did this to myself when I first went vegan, was my world lens has shifted. I have this new framework and I need to make sure that in absolutely everything I do, that I am asking that question, is this the vegan thing to do? Which is in a general sense good, but I feel like there's just such huge pressure. And we see that in a lot of the emails that we get of people that are like really sweating these really tiny instances of trying to figure out what vegan is. So in that instance, I feel like, yes, I think that to me in that instance, if it's to the point where it's making it hard for you to practice it and you're like really having mentally a hard time with it, I feel like in that instance, I would call that too vegan.
This is interesting, Andy. This is interesting. Cause I think in the past, I think I would be right there with you 100%. But now I'm thinking and I'm saying, okay, I totally agree with you that someone who is 10 rungs higher, living in the woods, foraging mushrooms, is unrelatable to someone who might be a few rungs below where we want them to be, right? I agree with that. But as you said, I'm not going to tell that person that they shouldn't be doing that thing. And so I feel like I'm at this point where I'm like, not everyone is going to be an advocate. And I think that an activist, and I feel like that's okay. And if someone wants to be that person, and I get again what you're saying about like internal pressure and those things, but if that's like how that person is living and it's working for them, I feel like I don't necessarily see anything wrong with that. Now, I think this is different than someone who might be 10 rungs up and goes to someone else who is already vegan and says, you're not doing enough, you're not good enough, you need to be doing this, this, or this. Then I feel like there's like an issue with that. I don't think I would label that as the other person being too vegan, but I would label that as the person not being entirely helpful at all to the person that's, you know, maybe a little bit lower down on the rung as them. But yeah, I don't think that I would say that person who is living out their ethics to the nth degree is necessarily too vegan if it's the thing that works for them, I guess.
Yeah. And I feel like that's what I was attempting to say and not very successful at it. And while we're offering clarifications, I know that like the example of the perfect person is living in the woods, foraging mushrooms. I want to acknowledge that there are people that like live that way. And so I guess for the purposes of our conversation, I hope people take that the spirit of that is like someone who lives in an urban setting or like live in the suburbs or whatever, and is making a wild transition to like off the grid, growing their own stuff, et cetera. So just want to throw that little disclaimer out there.
Yeah. No, I mean, Andy, I think the way that, yes, I agree with you. The way that we are presenting this person is maybe not, it's, I would say is like in a neutral light, not necessarily in a positive light, but you know, I applaud anyone that's absolutely minimizing the amount of animal exploitation that is going on around them, for sure. Even if it's not like an achievable thing for everybody, I think like I would applaud that specific person.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that is good. And I think that,
well, I guess here's the thing I want you to clarify, Andy. What is the thing that's too vegan, you were saying? Because you said there is something that's too vegan. There is such a thing.
Well, so as you were talking, I started to shift my position a little bit, Paul.
I'll allow it.
And I feel like perhaps it's because I'm just thinking about it more from a semantic difference kind of thing. And I don't know if, I don't think that's the spirit of the question that Jacoby has asked, but I'm going to start to talk about the semantics now. I don't think there's anything that's so much as like too vegan, but I feel like there are other adjectives that you could throw on there, or like, you know, descriptors. It's like you're too hyper-focused on something to the point where it lessens your quality of life, or lessens the quality of life of like your loved ones or something like that, or you're too... I want to say judgmental, but you're too judgmental. You're too isolationist about yourself and looking down on everyone below you. I don't know if that's too vegan. I feel like we often describe that attitude to vegans because there is very much kind of a moral superiority complex amongst a lot of vegans. But I feel like it's those things that are the too much, and it's not necessarily like the veganism that is too much, which maybe that's just a semantic thing. Again, I don't think that's what Jacoby is getting at, but how do you feel about that clarification?
Well, I'm on board with what you're saying, talking about the person who is like, you know, going to a new vegan and being like, oh, you're doing this wrong and you're doing this wrong and you're doing this wrong. Like, I think, again, I don't know what the exact adjective, maybe judgmental or trying to be superior, morally superior or something. There's some negative adjective that I want to attach to that thing.
Surprise.
But Andy, what about the person who is, I don't know. I don't know if I feel the same way about the person who is not doing that, that maybe is putting a bit more pressure on themselves, but isn't doing it like outwardly. I don't know if I would apply a negative emotion to that, because it's like, that is a person who maybe finds it difficult in some ways to live up to the ethics that they have said, this is what I believe is right. And it's a little bit difficult for me, but I'm doing it because I believe it's right. And the fact that it's a little bit difficult makes it so that there's a little bit more pressure in certain aspects of their life. Maybe I'm finding it hard to assign a negative adjective to that.
Well, I guess with everything, there's degrees to that, right? Because there's the person who is vegan, who maybe has some cravings for, you know, cow's milk cheese or something like that. And then there's the person who is vegan, who is maybe going hungry because they haven't been able to research the dyes in some food or, you know, something like that. That's like not finding like, oh, I have to research if there's bone char and I'm not going to eat this thing, even though I'm like really hungry right now. And that's going to negatively impact me and something like that. Like, I feel like there's degrees to that, but yeah, no, I mean, I think that for a lot of people, when you first go vegan or maybe even longtime vegans, I don't know, but, that it is a difficult thing. And a lot of us do push through that because we believe it is the right thing to do. So that's not what I'm talking about, but I think that there is the attitude that is saying, I must examine absolutely every tiny little thing that I'm doing, which I think is obviously a worthy enough pursuit. Like, why not? Obviously that's what we're doing on the podcast. But when it gets to a point where it becomes like an unhealthy obsession, or it causes you to harm yourself in some way, to me, that feels like that's too much. But I don't know if I attribute that to the veganism or if I attribute that to like some part of somebody's, you know, brain makeup or personality or something like that. So that's why I kind of backpedaled on the too vegan thing, because I feel like the vegan thing is not what is the too much, but it's like how people are practicing it and how people are like letting it consume them in a certain way that is negative, in my opinion. That, I guess that's what I'm trying to say. I don't know if any of that made sense.
No, Andy, I think I'm understanding. And I certainly agree. I don't want people to be harming themselves in any way by being, let's just talk about vegan specifically, by being vegan. And I mean, I don't know. It's tough because I want to say the solution, you know, I want to hope that the solution would be for that individual. The solution is, or the problem you could say is that they are trying to live in a way that right now society is not structured in a way that they are able to live the way that they want to live. And so the solution is that easy, Andy. The solution is that they need to change the structure of society and they need to change the way that things work, which I would argue is what we are collectively, the collective vegan we, are trying to do, is we are trying to change how these systems work. And it is going very, very slowly, Andy, and it is a very, very difficult process. But I think, like, that's what that's the solution to that person who is really, really struggling in some way with, like, I really don't want to participate in X, Y, or Z, but I am finding it very, very hard not to do these things because that's just the way that society is structured. And this is the last thing I'll say, Andy. Like, maybe they can find some solace in, like, the fact that they are working with the movement to try to shift society in that way, so that one day for people like that are similar to them, they will be able to live to that nth degree that they want to live to. And maybe they can take solace and not live that way because it might be unsustainable for them. But knowing that they are kind of trying to push forward towards that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is something that helps me in times when I'm like, things are not how I need them to be, and I'm not living in accordance with my ethics. But I know that by living in accordance with my ethics in the ways that I can, and then by, you know, being an advocate in the world, that I am pushing towards that future where maybe I'll never be able to live fully in accordance with my ethics, but hopefully, you know, the next person down the line will be able to, if, you know, our planet isn't boiled alive or whatever it is.
Now, Andy, I would say, how would you respond to what I imagine would be the common response is this a cop-out?
So when you say cop-out, you're referring to someone that would say you're giving yourself a pass on the, you know, these maybe smaller little things or things that are big, for instance, like medication being tested on animals or something. But you're giving yourself a pass for doing those things because you're thinking you're working towards a world, but that shouldn't alleviate your moral responsibility to abstain from whatever it is in the here and now. Are you saying that's what they're saying is the cop-out aspect of it?
Yeah. Because I think, and that's not necessarily an external thing, the cop out, like, I think that can come internally as well. Like feelings of, I feel guilty about this thing because I feel like I'm copping out, by saying to myself, well, I'm working on this in some way and maybe next generation, it'll be better. But for me, it's okay for me to participate in this thing because it's too difficult, you know? And again, I think that's putting it for the things that we are talking about, that's probably putting it lightly. But
yeah, because like I don't view the things that we're likely talking about it's like even participating in, you know, it's sort of like something that is unwillingly thrust upon us through the virtue of living in a non-vegan world and in a capitalist society. You know, like it's not to me, again, I'll just keep going back to someone like researching the monodiglycerides in their otherwise vegan bread or something, that like to me, consuming that is way different than someone that is like actively choosing to purchase cow's flesh. Like those are two very different things. And I guess I am choosing to partake in not researching that bread, you know, very like super thoroughly. Like I'm just going off of the label, but I almost, I don't know, to me that doesn't feel like partaking in that. Whereas if I'm like, I am actively purchasing the flesh of a dead animal, I feel like I'm actively partaking in that.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, Andy, would you say another example of this might be taking a medicine that significantly improves your quality of life without researching whether or not it was tested on animals?
I mean, with that specific example, it seems almost certain that it was tested on animals. So I guess to me, that's even less of a question because it's like, seems highly unlikely that you would find medication that's not tested at this point. Yeah. Or has some testing at some point in the chain of, you know, production of an ingredient or whatever.
But is that like another example of this sort of, would you say that this is another example of this sort of thing that we're talking about?
I mean, I feel like that's way less trivial than the monodiglycerides in some bread. I feel like anyone that would tell someone that they're not vegan or they're not doing enough because they're refusing to take life-saving medication or even significantly life-improving medication, to me, that just feels like that's not the world I'm working towards. That's not a part of this world. If someone thinks that's a part of their vegan world to give people a hard time in the here and now about those things, that's not what I'm building right now. So it's outside of my ethics.
I can get behind that, Andy. I don't remember where we were going with all this.
Paul, whoever knows.
I feel like we just spent 5 minutes establishing a premise that I forget why we were establishing it and what we were then going to answer once we've established the premise.
Oh, boy. Well, Paul, I guess we could just bring it back to that question of, is there such a thing as being too vegan? Like, with all of these premises that we've established, you're still going to say there's not such a thing as being too vegan.
I'm going to say there's not, because I think, if only, Andy, because these things that we are discussing, that we've been rambling on about for the last 10, 15 minutes, I feel like are too varied and complex of ideas to just be boiled down to, hey, that person's being too vegan over there, you know?
Yeah.
Like I think I could never describe something like that, because it's not accurately conveying all these things that we've just been talking about.
Yeah. And I also feel like it might be all relative. It could be something that's like, anyone that practices veganism in a more, I guess, let's say, thorough way than you, people are going to say they're too vegan. But anyone that's not quite as thorough as you, you're going to be like, you're not actually vegan. And obviously people fall on different places in that spectrum of how they're practicing their veganism. So I do think that it's really relative. I guess for me, as like kind of my closing thought, you know, when I think about practicing my activism, I'm always trying to keep my eye on where am I on that ladder and how can I best help people up it. And I don't say that to mean that I consciously limit how far up that ladder I am going, but I guess I use it to frame my expectations that when I get down about the fact that I'm not growing all of my own vegetables and I'm on the solar grid and all of those types of things, that like my ability to be a good activist doesn't necessarily depend on doing those things, even if they are goals that I have at some point and I think are really important things for people to do if they can do. But I guess that's the spirit of this conversation that I am trying to have, that I don't think that we need to feel like we have to reach some like supreme vegan state of being in order to be good activists. So I think we'll probably leave this there unless you have any closing thoughts, Paul.
Only if we want to get into another 30-minute conversation, Andy. No, I'm good.
All right. Well, we would love to hear from you, dear listener. You can send your emails into thebeardedvegans@gmail.com, or you can just give us a ring at 3237 Beardo and leave a voicemail that is no longer than 3 minutes long, and perhaps we will include it on a future mailbag episode.
Is that a promise, Andy? No longer than 3 minutes? If it is longer than 3 minutes, it will not be included.
Well, if it's longer than 3 minutes, you get the hammer. You get the axe, because that is the length of time that you can leave a message before our answering machine will cut you off.
Very rude. Very rude answering machine.
Listen, I warn people about the 3-minute time limit in the message. Paul, have you even listened to my message?
I did listen to the message a while ago. Did you make a new one?
No. Okay. However, something that I mentioned, and I hope that you will take me up on this, is that every mailbag episode, we will change the voicemail and we will alternate who leaves it, which would leave you to change the voicemail after this most recent mailbag.
I better start scheming some ideas about how to make it fun and clever.
The gauntlet has been thrown down.
All right. Well, Andy, this is fun. I enjoyed this. If people also want to have fun at a potentially live and safe event, where can they see you?
Well, Paul, if you like fun, I have an event for you, because August 15th, I'll be at the Greenville Fun Fest in Greenville, South Carolina.
In Funville, South Carolina. Nice.
Yeah, that should be a pretty good time. August 22nd, I'll be at the Knoxville Veg Fest in Knoxville, Tennessee. And these are all outdoor events. So yeah, stop by the Compassion Co. table and say, what's up, Beardo? I'll hook you up with a button and or sticker or both if you want one, or we can just chat. That's cool as well.
Nice.
All right, Paul, somehow we received a physical letter for this unplanned, unforeseen miniature mailbag, and it's appropriately sized. It's a very tiny little envelope. Let me go ahead and open it up. All right. It says, I've left behind this little fact. You cannot kill what you did not create. I've got to say what I've got to say, and that's the following 7 words.
We are the Bearded Vegans, signing off. So yeah, Andy, I guess without further ado, let's get into it. But first, well, there is actually, some further ado. Yeah,
let me transition out of that.
Thank you.
I think we'll have a couple on the main mailbag episode that's happening in a couple. So a couple episodes. Oh, boy, let me say. And I, all right, I'm melting down here.
Who are they being betrayed by, if they even, yeah, whatever. I'm probably going to cut all this out.
This next question came in from Steph. This is going to be a little random, but I friend my sent. Friend my sent.
I friend my sent.
I think you could also think about it in terms of I guess that's the main way.
I guess there's really just the one.